Well, folks, thanks for being here today. I think the bus is probably gone by now, and the weed whacker stopped, so I think we'll go ahead and get started.
Did you turn the air on?
No, I've got to turn the air on. Just for some of all of you have been in a session before, so I don't have to go through all that. I'm just going to jump right in, and I'm very much looking forward to this conversation, partially because Michael's given me instructions from the last session on everything I need to cover, where he stopped and where I picked up, so now I had to think about that. But because really this is a conversation, I don't presume to be a leadership expert when it comes to using the Christian lens, but I have some things to get us started so we can think about it, and I'm very much looking forward to where the conversation takes us today. Before we dive in, I do want to just do a really fast recap. I'm not going to go through all the details, but this has been the week in terms of everything that we've covered. We began talking about what the research tells us on traits of leadership, and you'll see, of course, as we get into this, how many ways this starts to overlap as you start dealing with different frameworks. Then the next day, we dealt with the elements of transformational leadership, those people who are able to take individuals and organizations past what they thought they were capable of doing, and some of the characteristics that that go along with that. Then the third day, we looked at a model for causing or helping organizations to go through adaptive change. And so we talked about a variety of techniques that are not necessarily putting the leader in the role where that person's kind of at the vanguard and everybody's following. It's a very different model of thinking about what the leader does. And then yesterday we looked at four ways of beginning to diagnose and understand problems that organizations might have, which is the first thing a leader's got to be able to do and do well, is figure out what exactly is going on here. What is the problem? And I had a wonderful conversation last evening with a person, a pastor that's kind of been with us through this journey over the course of the week. And as we began to talk, what he thought was a problem of a person who had a vision that was somewhat different than where the rest of the church was, actually, as we began to diagnose the problem was apathy in the congregation that manifested itself by having one individual hijack an agenda and run with it, contrary to the church's wishes. So sometimes it takes a while to see whether or not what you think is a problem is the symptom or the problem itself. And that takes some tools to be able to do that. So today, the goal is really to think about this question. As Christians, are we really called to lead? Does that word leading, at least as it's oftentimes conceived, does that actually run counter to what Christ had in mind for our responsibility as Christians or for the conceptualization of the church? So that's the one question I want us overall to be thinking about. So as Christians, are we really called to lead? Well, some people absolutely believe we're called to lead, and John Maxwell is one of them. So if you think about the commercial Christian press, I'll just read you a few of the titles if you want to read Maxwell. The Maxwell Leadership Bible, Developing the Leader Within You, Developing the Leaders Around You, the 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership, the 21 Indispensable Qualities of a Leader, Becoming a Person of Influence, the 21 Most Powerful Minutes in a Leader's Day, Failing Forward, the 17 Indisputable Laws of Teamwork, the 17, he's running out of numbers, the 17 Essential Qualities of a Team Player, Your Roadmap for Success. I'm actually in the middle of this one right now, which is a devotional, and it takes you week by week and just offers a variety of texts for you to think about and qualities and questions that you face as a leader. So, but commercial press is very much in this space. Then there's Bill Robinson, who's the president at Whitworth University, who has a book called Incarnate Leadership, Five Lessons from the Life of Jesus. And so he, as a university president, takes what he's learned in the life of Jesus and applies it to his work in leading a large and complex organization. And then the famous business book called Jesus, CEO. Which is a 1995 work by Lori Beth Jones. So there are lots of folks that are writing in this space and are making money doing it. So So there are folks that would argue, yes, by all means, Christians are called to lead. The Bible's filled with leadership advice and leadership lessons, and they have really organized a framework for understanding that. So I guess I wanted to ask today that we pursue this question first from the law and then from the gospel. Just to pick up my charge from 9 o'clock. Okay, so let's start with the law, and if we think about leaders and leadership in the Old Testament, let's just put up on the board all the people who were leaders that come to mind.
Moses.
Abraham.
David.
Solomon.
Probably Noah.
Esther.
You radical man.
I'm
radical feminist.
Well, say more.
Ezra and Nehemiah.
Ezra? I was wondering if anybody was going to deal with the cupbearer. Okay. All right. So, let's talk about first traits that we see in these men and in Esther. Some traits that you think are traits you associate and why you come to the conclusion, because of their traits, that they're leaders. Pick whichever one you want, but let's just apply some of them. All right, let's start with Moses. He's usually the one that jumps out first.
God spoke to Moses.
But what God could speak to many people, and they might not be leaders.
But he saw the cloud. He saw. He was told to follow a particular avenue, and then the people followed.
Okay, so would you say in the story of Moses that Moses was a vessel or a vehicle?
Absolutely.
Through which God led?
Yes.
That sense of self or ego wasn't there?
He was certainly reluctant.
Ah.
Yes.
The reluctant leader is a archetype in the leadership literature.
If you're looking at your traits, certainly determination. There were a few obstacles.
Okay. So determination.
Integrity.
He's probably, by virtue of the position that he held, at least initially, he must have been pretty intelligent.
Okay. I thought you were going somewhere. Where is his authority? Right?
Right.
His authority was given by God. So he had authority.
But the people had to recognize that.
They affirmed it.
Yeah. So it's still...
Is that a sociability issue?
Yeah. I was just going to say, they still have to give him power. Moses still needed the power of the people, even though he got it from God.
I'm going to talk a little bit about that matter of... we talked a few sessions ago about this matter of authority being formal. That is, it comes from a position. Or informal, that it is bestowed or conferred. Can you think about, in the story of Moses, is there that sense of conferral by the followers?
Well, there's the anti-example when they start to fall on the golden calf.
All right.
I mean, that's the opposite. Yeah. But, I mean, it shows he had it for a while, doesn't it?
What was the sign, or what signs did the people receive in order to understand the authority of Moses?
Ten commandments.
The snake on the stick.
Go ahead.
The snake on the stick.
Snake on the stick. Michael, anything from your vantage point in terms of authority or revelation of authority?
I think that his sense there of authority is simply speaking what God asked him to say, even though at times that would be quite foolish. Like go to Pharaoh and say, "Let my people go." So I mean, there I think there was his authority was that word.
So I don't know that you have this model in play. I don't even know that it's in play anywhere in the Old Testament. That this model of authority being conferred by the followers.
There might be one, and that's at Sinai, as God is on the mountain, and the people, you know, are fear and fear and trembling, and they basically say to Moses, "You go up the mountain, you know, because we touch this mountain, God's threatened to kill us, so there's no way we're going there. You do it, Moses." So one could say that's a conferral.
That's a conferral of power, and he goes up and he comes down.
Right.
And so now he's been given.
He's been given
the conferral. But I would say that because he knows and because he has received a calling from God, that he has the confidence and the determination and the faith, which is a dimension that doesn't, of course, appear in any of this literature. Right? So I think that's certainly something that you see in Moses. And most folks that write in leadership vein will immediately gravitate to Moses and give that accord to Moses in leadership. Let's pick another one. Let's go to Esther.
Integrity.
Integrity.
Intelligence.
It wasn't terribly social.
So that sense of empathy, emotional intelligence, sensitivity.
She had the right selection for who to be empathetic toward. So it's an interesting twist on sociability.
Any other comments in terms of traits in Esther?
Determination.
Mm-hmm. Let's pick one more, David.
And cross off integrity.
Self-confidence.
He's another reluctant, in some ways, reluctant leader initially. You know, he seems the least logical brother to be anointed.
Out in the field, yeah.
So certainly a journey from reluctant leader to a very different place.
Mm-hmm.
Use of coercive power. And
yeah, maybe he wasn't reluctant. Maybe he was just unexpected. It was unexpected that he would become the leader initially.
All right. Does anybody, in terms of any of these other figures, a particular trait that comes out that might be different than anything else we've talked about so far? No.
Well, I think in someone like Abraham, but I think they're in Moses too. They're wonderful negotiators, or you could say they're really good in conflict management. Right? I mean,
the
you
political,
know,
and they operate in the political frame.
Yeah, and I mean not just simply with the people, but I think they show greatest finesse as Abraham is bargaining, if you will, with God not to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And of course, Moses is always negotiating with God to say, you know, it really wouldn't look good for you, God, to destroy all these people. I mean, you know, let's think of a different way.
Great insight. You put forward Nehemiah. So tell us a little bit about, just in terms of your own thoughts on Nehemiah and how Nehemiah relates to leadership.
Well, Ezra and Nehemiah, and particularly Nehemiah, are the ones responsible for the, if you want to talk about it, resettlement of Israel again in Judah after the exile. And so particularly Nehemiah, who is the kind of also the representative of the Persian king, is the one responsible for making sure that particularly Jerusalem is resettled, the walls are rebuilt, and so on and so forth. Lots of difficulties happen. They try to do it, and there's the kind of the haves and the have-nots, and there's all sorts of unfair labor practices, if you will, and Nehemiah is the one who has to come into that situation and straighten it all out.
There's some that would say Nehemiah is a great case study for middle management, leadership at the middle management level. That he's got the king, he's got his position as the cupbearer, so he's actually earned the trust of the senior leader in the organization, and then he's empowered to go and to motivate a group of people to rebuild, and has to, in essence, form a team and work through the navigation of forming a team. So those of you that might be sitting in a complex organization have middle management responsibilities, go back to Nehemiah. There are opportunities there to just think about a very good example of how one navigates in that sphere and how one exercises leadership. All right, so those are some introductions. It's not uncommon for people to think about Old Testament leaders as heroes or heroines, that there's that sense of being larger than life, of being out in front of the group and everybody following. So a real sense of who's the leader and who's the follower. Do we have that in the New Testament?
Paul.
Okay, go ahead and elaborate.
Well, I mean, he certainly was, although he, as Michael said, you know, this week, he was sort of self-deprecating and the least of the apostles and so on and so forth. Yet, you know, it was Paul who was the motivational inspiration for all of these, Gentile churches that and probably a key in establishing, getting those congregations going and keeping them sort of on track. And, you know, he was dealing, he'd write his letters to various probably leaders in these congregations. So he was sort of the leader's leader in the early Christian movement. At least as I see it.
I call him a serial entrepreneur. That sense of starting, building. Mm-hmm. He was a builder. Mm-hmm. But how did he build? What was his approach to leadership? What was his approach to the followers? And how would you compare or contrast it to what we see in some of these Old Testament heroes and heroines? What's the difference?
I think he remained on the balcony. You want to phrase that. He was always there and talking and pushing them.
Except for Timothy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And his letters were always speaking of love and concern. He immediately conveyed that sense of gratitude for who they were. So he invited them into it.
The gospel. The message of the gospel.
Isn't he the ultimate small group starter as opposed to lifting the banner and leading the people out of Egypt? He's encouraging and lighting fires and enabling others to take hold and develop the gospel in other places.
All right, so
he's not asking everybody to follow him. He's saying, no, you go, you go, you go, you go.
So there's an unleashing, right? There's a setting free of the capacity of the individuals. There's an empowerment. So there's an empowerment model that appears to operate in the New Testament that is different in terms of conceptualization. And you have to take it all the way back to the master. And I'd like to talk a little bit with you, or just to pick your brains a bit on how Jesus approached leadership. How did Jesus approach leadership?
He built a team.
He built a team. And how did he do that? I'm sorry?
A team of one too many.
Or was that firing?
Maybe he should have exercised.
He needed an annual evaluation.
Put Peter in charge of human resources.
Authority, changing water to wine and miracles.
So he certainly was able to, in so many ways, demonstrate the conferral of power. And it wasn't from the people. The followers were irrelevant there. But he did. Let's talk about that team a little, just for a couple of minutes. How did he put his team together? How did he do it?
Just say, come on, follow me.
Did he say it to everybody?
No. He's specific.
The more you read, you kind of wonder, what good were they? What they do for him?
But you talked about the diversity of voices this whole week. Yeah. Of naysayers, and he didn't pick the establishment. So I think of our own structures, the old guard. He picked folks out of that, away from that group.
So he didn't pick the expected by any means. He picked people that came from all walks of life and all different perspectives, and some that you'd never imagine would have the potential. And through teaching and through inspiration, these people were able to achieve something that they never thought would be possible. So there's certainly a bit of transformation in there in terms of how he approached it. But a diverse team of people, very different walks of life, very different perspectives. So that was certainly different. What kind of structure did he use for his organization? How was it structured?
Had a treasurer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He led by example. Just example after example after example. He didn't seem to worry a whole lot about organization.
So you'd say that structure was virtually non-existent.
Yeah.
There weren't any particular rules about how things organize. And when Jesus was gone, of course, people that were trying to build the church had to create all of that, which is one of Paul's real contributions.
I think one of the small structure things is he doesn't send people out by themselves as much. And when they go on, when the disciples go on their missions, he sends them out in pairs. And so there's this connectedness as far as it's a very basic organizational structure, but nobody's going off on their own necessarily when Jesus is alive.
Which is pretty smart, because that way you're testing the teaching against somebody else.
Yeah.
You're always that's the balance.
Yeah.
Whenever you're preaching, there's always somebody else there that has knowledge as well, and it keeps it in check. So that actually is very...
We had a few weeks ago, I came the gospel text was when Jesus sends them out two by two, and that's the one where he says, if they don't receive you, shake the dust of that town off your feet. And I wonder if he didn't send them out two by two so one of them could say, well, maybe it's not quite time to shake the dust off your feet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hang in there a little bit longer.
Or just the opposite. It's time to go.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
One telling the other.
Exactly.
I would say the other thing you could say is Jesus, in terms of structure, was the ultimate train-the-trainer model.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Got 12, you got 72, and you just got that, you just have that sense of... able to reach extraordinary capacity.
Hands-on staff development.
Big on personal development. So you can look at these and just click them right off. You know, that he lived the example that he hoped his followers would live, that he inspired them to do something that they thought they were capable of, that he constantly challenged them intellectually, telling parables that had to be decoded, trying to encourage them to be creative and going out and spread the word, not telling them how, just sending them out, saying, this is it, and then they were going to invent it. And he gave them the power to be able to do that. And then finally, each one individually considered so that there was that individual and personal relationship with each one of those disciples. So I think you could probably go back, and Burns probably needs to rewrite the book, because this is really the model of transformational leadership and was able to accomplish it. Let's take a look at a couple things Jesus says about leadership. And if you want to grab a Bible, you're welcome to do it. If you don't, I'll read them for you just to move it through. The first time we encounter it's in Matthew, 20th chapter, 25th verse. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." So Jesus turns the concept of authority and leadership upside down. Really the first to do that. That's his entire approach to leadership, to reverse the expected. In Mark, the 9th chapter, 33rd verse, a similar conversation. They came to Capernaum. When he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the road?" But they kept quiet, because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, "If anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and the servant of all." He took a little child and had him stand among them, taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but the one who sent me." So again, that any time that concept of who's the best, who's the leader of the disciples, he negates it. Every time that opportunity comes. And the disciples just don't get it, right? So let me go to Luke here. We've got Luke 22, the 24th verse. Let's see what you're saying. I'm going to tap this one. Right. On the night in which he was betrayed. "Also a dispute arose among them as to which of them was considered to be greatest." There's a problem there in that team they had to be working on. Jesus said to them, "The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors. But you are not to be like that. Instead, the greatest among you should be like the youngest, and the one who rules like the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who is at the table? But I am among you as one who serves." So I think Jesus's conceptualization of leadership is very clear.
I would argue, though, and maybe I'm going to dissent here, I'll try not to be an antagonist, that the team failed. I mean, it never got it, even after the Pentecost event, and that Paul was the one that really, Paul comes in and it really saves the church.
Agree? Disagree?
Just a little. I'm different. Is in some of those passages that you read, Mark, why couldn't they be understood as transactional? That, you know, like you said, the disciples just didn't get it, and so they're always arguing who's going to be great, and so the boss comes in and in that transactional way. So, you know, look at you dummies. You didn't get it again. It's wrong. Here's the way to see. Here's this kid. See, be like this kid.
I think you're right on the money. In that particular set of instances, he's using transactional leadership management by exception. That is, they do this and he corrects them. You got it wrong. So he does. I mean, he does correct in order to try to change behavior. But I would say that what he believes, his conceptual model for leadership is revealed in those rebukes.
Oh, so that you're saying that he's incorporating some transactional elements under the umbrella of the transformation.
Of the transformation. Sure. A transformational leader will, from time to time, use those transactions. And you use whatever's in your toolbox in order to move them along. But I would say that that it would be management by exception, but the framework that has, the mental model that he has for how it should look is revealing in the correction that he gives them. Okay, so let's jump over to take a look at Paul, because Paul does add structure. He has all of these words, and I'm no Greek scholar here, Michael, but he's got presbyteros, he's got episkopos, diakonos, and poimen, right? So he's got all of those different structures. They're elders. The episkopos, those are the people that see to it, right? The overseers, those who see to it. The deacons, or the diakonos, and then the shepherds. So he has language for people that perform functions in the church as he sees it. But he also, I think, in most of his letters, except for Timothy, in most of his letters, he does everything in his power to negate status. So Paul's vision of the church is not one of status. Let's find the first one here. Is 1 Corinthians, 3rd chapter, 5th verse. What, after all, is Apollos? And what is Paul? Only servants, through whom you came to believe, as the Lord has assigned to each his task. I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, but God made it grow. So neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who makes things grow. The man who plants and the man who waters have one purpose, and each will be rewarded according to his own labor. For we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field, God's building. So a sense of, you know, I'm just a person who plants a seed. Another person waters. It's my task. I'm not to be held up as a leader. I'm nobody. And you'll see it again, the 4th chapter. Let's see, the 6th verse. Now, brothers, I have applied these things to myself and Apollos for your benefit, so that you may learn from us the meaning of the saying, do not go beyond what is written. Then you will not take pride in one man over against another, for who makes you different from anyone else? What do you have that you did not receive? And if you did receive it, why do you boast as though you did not? So that sense of your place and keeping your place. In the 19th verse, same chapter. But I will come to you very soon if the Lord is willing, and then I will find out not only how those arrogant people are talking, but what power they have. For the kingdom of God is not a matter of talk, but of power. What do you prefer? Shall I come to you with a whip, or in love and with a gentle spirit? The concept of leadership being an act of love rather than an act of power is something that is reinforced over and over again in Paul's letter to the Corinthians. And then finally, in 1 Corinthians, the 12th chapter, 27th verse, now you are the body of Christ, and each one of you is a part of it. And in the church, God has appointed, first of all, apostles, second, prophets, third, teachers, then workers of miracles, also those having gifts of healing, those able to help others, those with gifts of administration, and those speaking in different kinds of tongues. There's your org chart. All are apostles. All are prophets. All are teachers. Do all work miracles? Do all have gifts of healing? Do all speak in tongues? Do all interpret? But eagerly desire the greater gifts. And then he talks about, and I will show you a most excellent way. And he's into love. So he has a model of division of labor and responsibility in the church, each offered as a gift. Now, Timothy, of course, presents a whole different set of circumstances because the church at Ephesus is in a lot of trouble. Paul is worried. He can't get there. So rather than being the mentor and offering and empowering people, he says, you know, Timothy, let's cut to the chase. And he's very, very prescriptive. So he lays out how to put the church together. In 1 Timothy, the third chapter, here's a trustworthy saying. If anyone sets his heart on being an overseer, he desires a noble task. Now, the overseer must be above reproach, the husband of but one wife, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not given to drunkenness, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. And on he goes in very great detail. This is a person that you can empower as an episcopos, that is, the person that's to see to it. So here, Paul gets very, very prescriptive. It's a wonderful, you know, reading Timothy and Titus using a lens of leadership, you see Paul in his role as a mentor. And we haven't talked about it this week, but that's a whole other conversation about leader as mentor and that desire to take very seriously preparing for the people who will follow you as a trait of an effective leader, that you begin to prepare for your own leaving when you begin your work. And Paul, clearly in his latter days, looking at Timothy as a person that he could mentor and to help him think through how to lead and build the church in Ephesus, and for Titus in Crete, that same thing. You really see Paul's strong desire to mentor and to develop. So as we look then from the Old Testament to the New Testament, we're moving from this sense of clearly defined leader and follower to a model that's much more operating in this way, that is empowering and allowing individuals to grow the church without a lot of prescription, but with a great deal of sense of being empowered to build without a lot of structure. What I'd like to do then is to take some of these ideas and share a leadership model with you that comes out of this kind of approach. And I think you've heard this, certainly heard this language before. And this is a body of leadership thought that started with Robert Greenleaf in 1970, and this is servant leadership. And servant leadership comes out of this continuum: a concern for self and self-interest, and a concern for others. Here, we have ethical egoism. Here in the middle, utilitarianism. And here, altruism. So, high concern for self, low concern for others, ethical egoism. What is the aim of a leader who is operating in the sphere of ethical egoism? What's the operating premise? A person that's leading.
I sort of know best. He features himself as having more insight or perhaps intelligence than those he's working with, and I've got the answer for you. Here it is.
Okay. All right. So.
And presumably he's operating in an ethical. You know, at least his perception is that he's operating ethical, that his solutions or prescriptions are ethical.
What is good? Yep. Go ahead.
If it's Ayn Rand's school of thought, selfishness is a good thing.
What's good for me is best for my organization.
What's good for GM is good for the country.
But this is really down to the leader. What's the best thing for me is going to mean the best thing for the organization. Ethical egoism.
Self-aggrandizing.
Just directed towards self. The good, a sense of being good.
Is that where some of the Christian evangelists fall into that category?
You know, I don't know that I could plot them there. Oh. You know, I can't, you know, I don't know their mental model for what is good. I don't think they profess that.
Prosperity gospel? Yeah.
I'm sorry?
Prosperity gospel.
Prosperity gospel, I guess. What's good for you, mm-hmm. success for you is going to mean success for your organization. Let's contrast them all. Maybe the pieces will fall together. How about a medium level of concern for self and a medium level of concern for others? Utilitarianism. What is the good or the end in a utilitarian approach to leadership?
It probably is more likely to be successful in a way because it's a balancing and tempering. We haven't moved to altruism yet, but there's almost that kind of sense of us and them and either of these, and this middle ground may have what it takes to move something forward because there is this balance.
The greatest good is what will be of greatest benefit to the greatest number. So you're aiming for the greatest good. The end is that which will benefit the most. All right, so how about altruism then? What's just the last little tweak to get to something that's altruistic?
Best for the other.
Right. Best for the most people, even if it's bad for me.
Cost to me.
So that is a sacrifice of self for the benefit of the organization. So when one begins to think about leadership from a servant, or if you want to take it up a notch from there, an ethical lens or approach or theory of leadership means then that you're somewhere on this continuum, but what you're focused on is what is good. What is good? What is right? And that is your mental model for thinking. For thinking about it. Yes.
Just out of curiosity, what do you call the upper right-hand corner?
High concern for others and high concern for self. I don't know that it's on a model I've seen.
Church headquarters in Chicago.
There you go. Now I understand.
It's easier.
Works for me.
Yeah. All right, so those that enjoy this, which is probably Michael's bailiwick in particular, these theories, because they're all dealing with the consequences or ethical ends, are teleological theories. That is, that these are really looking at what the end is. There are another set of theories that fall under here that have to do with duty. Or deontological. So those things that are about, it doesn't really matter what the end is, it's that we need to be things. By observing and being dutiful in certain ways, we are ethical leaders. So those people who are honest, those people who keep promises, those people who respect others, those people who are fair and just, in that model, it doesn't really matter what the ends are, that because the person exhibits these qualities out of their duty to the organization, they are good leaders. So that's another way of thinking. And some of us operate with that mental model. You know, we're thinking really about the duties and behaviors of the person in the leadership role, and we determine their effectiveness on those qualities more than any other thing. And then there are another group of theories that are based on virtue. And those you can tie all the way back to Aristotle and Plato, courage, temperance, generosity, etc. So servant leadership, just a few qualities then, which I think might be the theory that you can most align with Christian leadership, says that first, leaders should be attentive to the concerns of others, that they should empathize with them. It's this back here. They should be focused on caring and nurturing. our human resource frame from yesterday, that leadership is bestowed on the person who by nature was a servant, that a person cannot be a leader unless they have been a servant. So in order to understand how to lead, one must understand how to serve and understand that firsthand. I tie that comment back to Shackleton, who went off in the merchant marine and had to behave as though he had no status in the Navy, and in the process of really working in that servant capacity, understood and was called to and led in a different way that ran counter to the operations of the Navy. That the focus of the leader is on the needs of the followers. Jump back to Shackleton. Remember, fella had frostbite. Shackleton takes his own gloves off, puts him on the other guy. Doesn't care about his own sense of self. It's more important that the crew be taken care of. That the goals are to make to allow the followers to be more knowledgeable. That is, give them all the information they need so that they can help make decisions. That you should make them more free for, right? That empowering and making people free, lifting the burdens and responsibilities of their status and opening them up. Allowing followers to be more autonomous. Allowing them to be more like servants, but by choice. So just freeing, that sense of freeing everybody within the organization and empowering. Along with this concept of servant leadership comes a very strong drive for social justice. So there's a great connection of servant leadership with ensuring social justice in that relationship. Comments, observations. Do you know servant leaders? Have you worked with them? If so, how would you describe them? Anybody work with a servant leader?
Well, this is not a system model, but I think my dad was an altruistic leader, and he really did enjoy his children being happy more than his own happiness, and I think that's how he, you know, led our family.
So his satisfaction came from seeing other people.
It really did. It really did. Yeah.
We're affiliated with a Christian community boat shop in Maine that builds boats and brings people in to kind of reevaluate their lives. But anyway, they had a mentally retarded gentleman there for years. His name was Phil, and we'd all be working on boats and stuff. And Bobby ran this shop. He was the head guy. So Phil went to the bathroom, and all of a sudden we all got real busy because we knew what that meant. And Bobby, just like that, he'd just go right over to Phil, get him carried downstairs, because you had to carry him, he's in a wheelchair. I mean, he's, for me, has been the ultimate servant leader, because of that. He just doesn't even think about it. He just does it.
Well, I think observing on the Valpo campus, observing the Lutheran Deaconess Association deaconesses, you know, that's what they epitomize as servant leadership. And they really act out of it.
Give me an example of how that plays out when you see it and what that looks like and with it.
Well, that they are servants, literally. When they have a meeting, they write into serving you. You know, the washing is what they do. They're simple. But, you know, they come in, they give you drink and food, and that your needs are of utmost importance. And they just want to help people get along to be servants. And they really epitomize it.
You ever see that happen when you're in a meeting and the person who's actually chairing the meeting or in charge of the organization gets up, pours coffee for people? Little things that might be clues?
Yeah, I see that. I work in an emergency room with children, and so the very last thing lots of times is the popsicle. Give the kid the popsicle. And I can't tell you how many times it's the physician, the attending physician in the emergency room, who's seeing the child at the very last, running off to the refrigerator, breaking the popsicle, running it back and handing it to the child. And it's such a model of course I can do that. Or, you know, just that whole sense of we're all teamwork, we're just working together. It's not a matter of this is your job, or I'll send the nurse in, or I'll send the volunteer in with the popsicle, but the leader is, you know, him or herself will go do that.
So when you're in the middle of that environment, then how does that make you feel? What does that make you want to do? What is it like to be the, quote, follower in that environment? Let's talk about that a little bit.
It's almost not like you're the follower. It's almost like you're one of the effectively working cogs in this thing, and that you're carrying out a mission that is near and dear to all of your coworkers. And so it's not so much of, gee, I'm following that person, but I contribute.
I think what happens to me a lot in that situation is I realize immediately how selfish I am when I see someone else do something that then I wished I would have thought of. Then I'm always reminded that I'm operating on my schedule.
It's more of a partnership. And when that leader, the example that I'm thinking of is a leader of a prison ministry program that we have in our congregation. And this gentleman, and it makes no difference what project that he is in, you never have to work any harder than he does. But you're going to really put in an effort to work as hard as he does. If it comes to leading the worship session, he's involved in that leadership. If it's delivering the meal to the prisoners this is a kind of a halfway house type of a program, so it's parolees and so on. He'll be serving the meal or cleaning the tables or whatever. But he has this assumed authority. Because of all of the effort that he's put in, we have conferred the leadership role to him, so he becomes the authority, so everyone goes to him. So it is that partnership that I feel over there.
I'd say the other thing that, you know, because I'm a good Pennsylvania German, when I see something like that happen, I'm guilty, but then I'm motivated. But then when I step back and look at it, it's incredibly symbolic for me as a picture of the kingdom of God.
One of the symbols that kind of comes to mind when we talk about the medical center, I've worked in the medical center for years, and there's an enormous difference in sort of the nurse managers who dress in scrubs, who dress like they are ready to work, and in fact actually do work when the thing gets tough, because partly that makes the mission rather than the hierarchy and the status so visibly important. And one of the places I worked recently, there was a wonderful nurse manager who always wore scrubs, absolutely on purpose. A new administration came in, and it wasn't too long before she was instructed to start dressing in the suit. And the theory was, well, you represent, you want to show be the dignity of your group of people, but partly was utterly counter to her management style, and it also represented a shift in the wind, and she also left not long after that. Mm-hmm. But that symbolism of just how she dressed.
Yeah, that's that the administrators didn't understand. They had a blind spot, big blind spot.
I guess the feeling that comes to mind for me is excitement of the potential power of the organization when all the hands are there for the common purpose, whatever the mission of the organization is.
Go ahead. I'm going to tie it to what Michael said later, but I'll wait till we're done. I'm ready to move on. Go ahead. What was that?
I was just going to say, servant leadership is actually one of the values that at the Good Samaritan Society, where I work, we do elder care. So I'm thinking about some of our managers, some of our facilities, we have a transactional leader who always gets things done on budget, and they're seen in some sense as a really good manager, but they don't understand relationships, and there's a lot of conflict and toxic culture at those places. There's other places where, yes, the managers are the servant leaders, and it's a very completely different environment in some of those places where, they're inspiring people to be who they are in terms of carrying out this mission of hospitality. It's a really nice, huge difference.
I was just going to say that the recognition of gratitude in terms of servant leadership, that I would not just be filling a spot in your structural flowchart, but I'm actually acknowledged as a full person and human being.
Gary, I'm a couple.
I think the former bishop, H. George Anderson, was a real servant here. He was, when he, on the first week he was there, he would come down to the cafeteria and meet with people, and just come up and say, I said, I'd meet with you. And you wouldn't believe how fast the word spread throughout the building. H. George is meeting with us at the cafeteria.
It just really inspired people.
Another way to put it is, you always knew he had your back. He was going to watch for
you. There's something that does unleash potential. I keep thinking, Michael, this morning, that sense of both that unleashing and that kind of deactivating. You know, your shift from one environment to the other was a deactivating of a kind of burden that was placed on you, a constraint, and that this suddenly opens up and drops that. Really allows an unleashing of potential. I would say, you know, as I think about the interactions of all these different approaches, that there is a high correlation between this approach and what happens in transformation. Only the idealized influence that's operating in a servant leadership model is really leading in a Christ-like way. And that is the idealized influence you really are leading as Christ models us to lead, and that unleashes an enormous amount of potential and the emotional investment of the people on the team is much higher because of that, because I think of that connection. And certainly as you think through your own leadership environment and as you watch leaders, or maybe if you're in a leadership role, that you might, you know, really think about how to focus your leadership effort and align it with a way of thinking about goodness that really starts to move things to a different kind of level. I'd like to, I keep coming back to this wonderful passage that we've organized all of our teaching around, and read it again in the context of today and see if anything new comes of it. For we do not preach ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. We are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed, perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not abandoned, struck down and not destroyed. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that his life may be revealed in our mortal body. So then, death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. And then jumping ahead, therefore we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. And as at least I listen to these words and read them over, I think about all the blessings I've had this week. Michael, it's been a blessing to hear your words, and you unlocked so much of this little passage for me as I've thought about Romans 1:1, and all of you in terms of what you brought here together as we looked at leadership together, whether it's these traits and theories or transformations or what it is that really Christ could call us to do in our roles as slaves. It's been a pleasure, and I wish you God's blessings. Those of you that are staying on, I wish I could be with you, and hope that at least some of this will give you something to think about as you go back to your churches, your schools, your organizations, and whatever God is calling you to do. I hope that this might open up for you more opportunities for leadership. So God bless you. Enjoy your time. Thank you.
Thank you.